Good afternoon. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. I'm Justice Ann Gardner. To my right is Justice Bill Meyer. To my left is...
I told them good afternoon.
To my left is Justice Lee Gabriel. And we're your panel for this afternoon. We have one case on the docket, and I'll ask the clerk to go ahead and call it, and we'll get started if you're ready.
The court will now call L.E. James Development Corporation and L.E. Joel Jr. versus Southwest Bank. May it please the court, Ms. Robin T. Card will argue for the appellant. Mr. Kyle T. Gray will argue for the appellate.
T. Card, proceed.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Robley Seacarn. I'm an attorney appearing on behalf of the appellants. This is a default judgment case. A default judgment case is relatively easy on the plaintiff. They have specific and straightforward requirements that they have to meet in order to obtain a default judgment in which the plaintiff does not answer the lawsuit. One of these basic requirements is that the citation must be properly served and the return must be on file for 10 days prior to the entry of judgment. This is provided by Rule 107. The burden is on the plaintiff to meet these requirements. It's not on the defendant. Texas courts for over 100 years now have required strict compliance with these requirements of Rule 107 in default judgment proceedings. Strict compliance must affirmatively appear on the record in order for default judgment to withstand a direct attack. I think when we are looking at this case in particular, it's important to look at the record as it appeared to the trial court when it was presented with the motion to amend the return of service. At that point, it was presented with the motion to amend the return with an attached amended return for each of the defendants, the corporation, as well as the individual, Joel Jr. It was not presented with any evidence. It was not presented with anything that evidenced that the defendants had any notice of this hearing, which is an issue I will get to in a few minutes. The court knew one thing for sure from this motion by the plaintiffs, and that was that the constable had gotten it wrong once. Supposedly, the constable had left off the word junior, which we know by case law from the Texas Supreme Court is required because a Lee Joel Jr. is not the same as Lee Joel. What it didn't know was why the junior was left off, didn't have any evidence as to how the constable knew that it had served Joel Jr., or knew that there wasn't a Joel Sr., knew that there wasn't a Joel the third, the fourth, et cetera, et cetera. It didn't have any evidence of that fact in the record.
And you're talking about at the hearing?
Well,
is there a separate hearing on the motion to amend and the actual taking of the default judgment, or was this all at the same time? It's unclear
well,
to me how that occurred.
Sure, that's a good question.
Is there a record of the hearing?
There actually was no hearing. There was no hearing on the motion to amend the return. There was no hearing on the motion for default judgment. All that was presented to the court was a filed motion for amended return and a filed motion for default judgment, both of which were filed on the same day. I believe it's 2 days later that the court signs the order amending the returns and signs the order granting the motion for default judgment. So that is part of our issue with notice. The defendants never had any notice of the hearing on the motion to amend the return of service. They had no chance to refute that they were served. They had no chance to offer any of their own evidence on the issue. They weren't notified at all. And part of our argument is that Rule 118 requires that notice. Rule 118 includes the phrase, upon such notice. If you think about the rules of statutory construction, you're supposed to give effect to all of the words and all of the phrases in a statute or a rule. If you were to...
You have to look at the words that follow that that say, and on such terms as it deems just.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, Your Honor, you do. You do have to give effect to all of those words. But I think, why would the legislature include a provision that says upon such notice if no notice would be sufficient? Why even include that? In fact, if you go back to some of the older cases that we, both parties have cited in their briefs, one of them is the Employers Reinsurance Corporation versus Brock, which was a 1934 decision. The predecessor to the current Rule 118 doesn't mention notice at all, doesn't say upon such notice. Nothing about notice. It says that the officer may amend the return with the court's approval. So at some point, the legislature, when they amended that provision of the rules, they included that notice provision. And I think that no notice is exactly that. There is no notice. You haven't met the requirement of such notice as provided in Rule 118.
Do you have any authority for the current Rule 118 that says that there has to be notice?
I think that some of the cases that we have signed in provide that there needs to be notice. I know that a lot of the cases that were cited by the appellees for the idea that there does not need to be notice, in those cases there was notice and there was a hearing. And I think our position is if there is contrary case law that says you do not need to notify the plaintiff, I think that's wrong. I mean, I'm sorry, you don't need to notify the defendant. I think that's wrong. It wouldn't be included in Rule 118 if they didn't intend for some attempt at notice to be had.
Let's take this forward, because you don't now and have never really denied that Mr. Joel Jr. was served, correct?
Correct.
So you weren't misled in any way.
Correct.
And it's my understanding that there was a decision not to file an answer to this original petition because he misunderstood the effect of a judgment.
Correct. And our response on that point is twofold. First of all, the motion for new trial in which those facts are recited was filed outside the plenary power of the trial court. The Rule 306A of Section 4, I believe it is, provides that you have to file a sworn motion, you have to present evidence at a hearing after notice to the other party in order to extend the trial court's plenary power. So I would say that motion for new trial is outside the plenary power of the court. We've already gone back and forth in motions on that, and this court denied arguments by the appellee with the similar reasoning. But even so, even considering in the motion for new trial, it admits that he was personally served, I still think that you have to go back, when you're applying Rule 118, you have to go back to the time the trial court considered amending the return of service. I think you have to look at what the trial court has, and if all the trial court has is an amended return and a conclusory motion that says, oh yeah, we forgot, you know, the constable forgot to put junior. The trial court doesn't have any information that the constable, which by the way, the amended return was filled out by the constable more than 30 days later after serving Mr. Joel Jr., you know, in which time I assume the constable served many different people on many different cases, you know, performed other duties of his job, and now he's supposed to come back and say, I remember serving Joel Jr. You know, I don't think that the court had any evidence in front of it that the constable made sure there wasn't a Joel Sr. or made sure there wasn't a Mr. Joel, or you know, how did he know it was Joel Jr.? Did he ask for identification? Did the person identify himself to the constable? I think that when you're considering Rule 118, you have to go back to the time of the trial court. I think it would be bad policy for the trial court to just accept whatever is filed with, you know, not even an attempt at notice, you know, no certified mailing to the last known address or any kind of attempt at notice. If there were an attempt at notice, there's also an argument that the trial court would at least be somewhat assured that the defendant had an opportunity to come and say, hey, I wasn't served, this isn't correct, this amended return is false. I think that that is how Rule 118 should be treated. Now on notice, you know, I think it specifically says upon such notice. I think if you ignore that portion of the rule, I think you're violating the rules of statutory construction and you're just glossing over it. I think it's a very important part of the rule. Another part of our arguments has been whether the motion to amend the return was on file for the requisite 10 days. The appellees have argued and cited some case law that says that the amended return, once filed, relates back to the date of the original citation and the date it was filed. That's nowhere in Rule 118. Nowhere in Rule 118 does it say the court may amend the return and it relates back to the first date of the original citation. I think the overriding rule is strict compliance with the rules, which I don't, these rules do not place a huge burden on the plaintiff. The plaintiff could get a amended return on file, wait 10 days, the required 10 days, and strictly comply with those 10 days, and get its default judgment. To say that it relates back, there, I don't think there's any support for that at all. And not to, also, the default judgment itself contains a material misrepresentation and a patent, I mean, it's patently false in that it states the amended return was on file for more than 10 days at the time the order was entered. This is not correct. The amended return, in fact, was filed more than 10 days after the order was entered. This is not strict compliance with the rules, which has been reiterated by court after court after court, that the plaintiffs must comply with those rules under Rule 107. Also, I'd also like to point out that the amended returns themselves, which were filed by the plaintiff, were defective. Under the 2011 version of Rule 107, which was just amended this year, the return of the officer or authorized person executing the citation shall be endorsed on or attached to the same. It's supposed to be attached to the citation. There's at least one decision out of the El Paso Court of Appeals that the failure to attach an amended return to the original citation is fatal, and this is an issue of personal jurisdiction. The appellate court held that the trial court did not have personal jurisdiction under the evidence and the return that had been filed.
Is this in your brief?
It's not in our brief. You know, it's something we recently came across. I believe it would be included as a subset of the greater issue. And also, I think, especially with this El Paso Court of Appeals opinion, which is Verlander Enterprises Incorporated versus Graham 932 Southwest 2nd 259, I believe that this says it's in-person jurisdiction, and you cannot waive jurisdiction. It's a jurisdictional argument. You can't waive it.
So they don't get any chance to respond to this? I mean, is this something you want to bring up in oral argument now, correct?
Well, I think that if you cannot waive the argument, I think we can bring it up. I think the appellee can respond to it. We can respond in letter briefs. I think it's a valid point that they didn't comply with the Rule 107 requirements as they were in effect at the time that the citation was filed and at the time the suit was filed. I don't think that you can file a defective return in which service is defective. Defective service is fatal. I don't think you can file that defective return and then file a secret motion with no notice to the plaintiff that you are requesting an amended return and get a default judgment. The requirements for a default judgment are plainly stated in the rules. It's not an incredibly heavy burden. They never had to argue the merits. I think they could be held to meet them.
Let me ask you a question about the motion for new trial that was filed that had the evidence or the admission that the correct defendant, in effect, was served. They withdrew that, right?
Yes. Yes, so, that motion was withdrawn.
But are you contending that that has any effect on whether we can consider it? Or is your argument just a legal one that we should consider the record as it stood at the time back when the default judgment was being taken?
I think it is both. I think that you do have to look at the record at the time as it was at the time the motion was filed. And I do think that that motion for new trial, as it was withdrawn, is outside the record of the trial court. There was no plenary court jurisdiction, and the record was withdrawn. There was no hearing on the motion.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we'll hear from Appellee, Mr. Gray, for the Appellee.
Good afternoon. My name is Kyle Gray, here for the Appalachian Southwest Bank.
Counsel.
May it please the court. Counsel is correct in stating this is a default judgment case, and the issue here is, I'd like to be very clear. It's whether there's error on the face of the record such that the judgment cannot stand. And my argument, I've divided it into two parts. Number one, the order authorizing the amendment of returns and its implications under the facts of this case. Now, of course, within this argument, I'll address the issue of notice pursuant to Rule 118. It wasn't addressed by counsel, but there was an issue of whether there was material prejudice to the appellant's substantial rights and whether the amended returns relate back. The second argument is that the defendant corporation, LEJ Development Corporation, was also properly served because its president, in the face of the record, shows that its president received service in this case. And there is authority specifically from this court that demonstrates that when it is the president of the corporation pursuant to the Texas Business Organizations Code, it's proper service. I'll rely on my brief for the remainder of the points. One thing that I would like to clarify, because in the appellant's brief there's seems to be a question as to whether, the order authorizing the amended returns was entered prior to the final default judgment. And I would just like to point the court to pages 85 and 86 of the record. 85 is the order authorizing amended returns. 86 is the final default judgment. And on each, it is stamped, beginning with the order authorizing the amended returns, it is stamped the court's minutes transaction number 14. The final default judgment is stamped court's minutes transaction number 15. So there is no question. It is clear that the trial court signed the order authorizing the amended returns prior to the final default judgment. And that is supported by page 233 of the record, which is the civil docket sheet from the trial court, which again, the trial court judge hand wrote what order he signed those in. And it supports what I just referenced for the court. That's significant because the amended returns are not untimely, and that's one of the primary arguments of the appellant's case here, is that they were untimely. And as the court is well aware, the seminal case of Higginbotham, If you have an order authorizing the returns, as well as the primate case, the Vespa case, those three cases made clear that if the amendment is prior to default judgment, then they're unquestionably timely. This is not an issue where they were amended after default judgment.
So we don't have to resolve a couple of issues about which, whether Vespa or the other court of appeals case out of our court that seemed to conflict really do, or whether Primate and Higginbotham conflict themselves.
Well, there are some issues, but I don't believe there's any conflict. In fact, another case that came out after in this court, it came out in this court after Vespa and after Primate, Dawson v. Briggs.
Yeah, that was the other one I was thinking of.
It discussed both of those cases, and it made clear that in Primate, there was no issue of an amended return at all in that case. And the one of the holdings from Primate that if the if an amendment came after default judgment, I believe it was the holding that if it came after default judgment, then it was that you could not amend. Excuse me, you could not amend after default judgment, and Dawson made clear that was dicta because there was no issue of an amended return in Primate. And Vespa was a case where clearly the amended return took place after the default judgment. It was months after, and there was no issue there as to whether the amendment took place before the default judgment. Those cases don't apply because here we have a case where the amendment occurred prior to final default judgment. And those cases support this outcome because they say the amendment must come before default judgment, and that's exactly what we have here. So I think they all really there is not too much conflict except for the holding in Vespa, which has since been clarified. Going back to the order authorizing the amended returns, that order effectively amended the original returns of citation. And again, that happened prior to default judgment. And the Higginbotham case states that Rule 118 allows for liberal amendment of the returns or the proof of service to reflect the true facts of service or the service that was actually had. And that's what we have here is an order, a motion, the motion to amend had the amended returns, copies of them, attached. And one thing I'd like to quote from Primate is the following. The return of service is not a trivial formulaic document. It has long been considered prima facie evidence of the facts recited therein. The recitations in the return of service carry so much weight that they cannot be rebutted by the corroborated proof of the moving party. We have amended returns attached to the motion, the Rule 118 motion to amend, which correct any defects, and I don't believe there's been any dispute from the appellants that, in fact, the defects were corrected by the amended returns. And the resuscitations therein carry the weight, as the courts have interpreted throughout the years. And because they corrected the defects, the order that authorized those amended returns essentially corrected the face of the record. There is no error in the face of the record.
Of course, their argument is because they didn't get notice of the hearing, they couldn't come in and rebut the prima facie evidence that the errors had been corrected.
Correct, Your Honor. And I'm glad I needed to move on to that argument. I believe counsel had indicated that the cases that are out there discussing this issue of notice, the amended returns were produced during a hearing such that there would have been notice because the other party would have been involved in that hearing and that there weren't any other cases to the contrary, something to that effect. But I would like to bring the court's attention to the Bavarian Auto House case. It's a case that's very similar I would submit to the case before this court. That's a case where it was a writ of error case, so similar to a restricted appeal. And in that case, in Bavarian, it was asserted that there was error in the trial court's finding that citation was served because the citation was issued and delivered to a Clint Hughes V. period Prez, vice president, I'm assuming. And the amended return stated delivery to Clint Hughes, in person vice president. The appellate court in Bavarian Auto House noted that the original return did not state that Bavarian was served by delivering to Clint Hughes in the capacity that was necessary. And it held that there was no error because Rule 118 was complied with. And Bavarian did not assert it was misled, and notice of the amendment was not required in that case. And I would submit that in that case, notice under Rule 18 was specifically addressed in the same context it is here today, because the appellate court in Bavarian Auto House went on to state that there was no error in not giving notice of the amendment. And it went on to state that there was no material prejudice because the appellants had not stated that they were in any way misled. And so we do have case law, specific case law, that Bavarian Auto House case, and I cited the three other cases. Employers Reinsurance case, I believe it was mentioned earlier, was another case where they said notice of the amendments is not necessary. We have cases in the state of Texas that do hold that notice pursuant to Rule 118 is not required. And of course, the express language, I interpret Rule 118 expressly, that it gives the trial court the discretion with respect to notice and the terms that it deems just for purposes of allowing or disallowing amendments. And
are you familiar with any cases that say notice is required under Rule 118?
I'm not familiar with any cases, Your Honor. If there are such cases, I believe the appellants have also failed to cite to any cases on that issue.
Right.
Yes, sir.
What was the style of the case that was first? Was there more than one petition filed in this case?
I do not believe so, no, Your Honor.
All right. What was the style on the petition that was filed in the plaintiff's original petition in this case?
Southwest Bank Plaintiff versus LEJ Development Corporation and L.E. Joel Jr.
So on the pleading that was actually served to the defendant, the name was clearly L. E. Joel Jr., and the name was clearly for the corporation, L. E. J. Development Corporation. In those pleadings, does it say that Mr. L. E. Joel Jr. is the president of L. E. J. Development Corporation in your original petition?
It does not state that he is the president, Your Honor.
Authorized officer, what's he called?
The registered agent.
Registered agent, okay. And in terms of the contentions on the part of Mr. Joel, and after the amendment of the officer, the return, the contention was not that he didn't know that he had been served as L.E. Joel Jr. They never contended that, did they?
I believe you're correct, Your Honor. They did not contend that he was not properly served.
If I read it correctly in the briefs, was that Mr. Joel's reason for not going ahead and answering the lawsuit was that he was under the misconception that a judgment against by the bank, against the corporation, and against him would not affect his personal assets?
Correct, Your Honor. That's in the two separate affidavits filed by Mr. Joel Jr.
Right. Thank you, sir.
Quickly, I would like to touch upon the issue of relation back. I think the case law and the law is very clear that no matter when an amendment is made, they relate back to the time of the original citations. Now, I don't believe when we look at the order authorizing the amended returns, it's necessary to even file the amended returns because we have an order from the trial court which by itself effectively amends the returns. To the extent the court was to find that the amended returns and when they were filed do matter, well, I believe the law makes clear that they do relate back. So they were timely filed pursuant to all of the rules.
And the copies in the motion were on file more than 10 days before the default was taken?
No, Your Honor. The motion and the copies on file were on file approximately 3 days, I believe, prior to default judgment. They were then filed approximately 13, the original returns were filed, excuse me, original amended returns were filed approximately 13 days, I believe, after default judgment.
But the original defective returns were filed more than 10 days, were on file more than 10 days.
Correct, Your Honor. Okay. Correct, yes. August 22nd, Your Honor.
Prepared to respond to their Rule 107 argument?
Your Honor, I'm not. I would submit that they've waived that argument. It is not a basis of the appeal, of this restricted appeal.
Well, if it's jurisdictional, I think we would have a duty to consider it anyway because it can't be waived if it's jurisdictional, But so would you like an opportunity to reply?
The court is inclined to allow the parties, to allow the appellants to make that argument, then certainly we would like to have a chance to respond. Finally, I would also like to see that my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you very much. If it's jurisdictional, I think we need to.
You should have an opportunity to respond.
Yeah. Would 10 days be sufficient, or 15 days to file a written response? Regarding this Rule 107 argument?
Your Honor, I'm not quite sure what their argument is.
Let them both file a letter brief.
What about 15 days for a post-submission briefing that issue, and then 15 days to respond? Would that be sufficient? All right, thank you. Thank you both for your arguments. Thank you for your good briefs. Appreciate your coming in. Oh, you have a, you have rebuttal. I apologize.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. That's okay. Okay. First, I'd like to start by saying and reiterating that strict compliance must be shown on the face of the record. On the face of the record that we have here, we see that there was no notice of the motion to amend the return of service. The returns were not on file, the amended returns, excuse me, were not on file for 10 days per Rule 107. The amended return has no citation attached, which was also required under Rule 107 as it was in effect at the time. And the record does not show that the order for amended return was before the default judgment. As far as material prejudice, I think that, again, as part of the Rule 118, the trial court has to look at whether the defendant will be clearly, materially prejudiced under that rule. How can the trial court make that decision when there's no notice to the defendant, there's no opportunity for the defendant to be heard on whether it was served, and to refute the amended return assertions or the assertions in the motion for amended return? The Higginbotham decision is a decision that both parties have cited, that the appellees have relied upon. I would differentiate that case. First of all, 5-4 decision by the Texas Supreme Court was not a clear win. It was also an appeal from a, it was a direct appeal from a motion for a new trial, meaning there was a hearing and there was evidence and testimony that was put on by the parties. The defendant was able to respond. In fact, in that case, Rule 118 was not raised. which is part of the issue of the dissent by the four justices who dissented. As far as the Bavarian case goes, first of all, I'd point out that in that case, the amended return was filed prior to the entry of judgment, and in response to the assertion that the minutes of the court reflect, according to the appellee, that the motion to amend was granted prior to the entry of the default judgment, the court's minutes, that's a clerical, a ministerial duty. That is not, there's no real basis for that in the clerk's record. The only evidence we have is that both were signed on the 22nd.
What about the docket sheet?
The docket sheet, I would have to say that's also a ministerial duty.
That's the handwriting of the judge, and the judge writes, I did this and then I did that?
Yes, I see your point, yes. But I still think, you know, whether the amended return was granted 10 minutes before the default judgment, I think you're still going back to the fact that the defendant has had no notice, has no opportunity to respond, you know, and the amended return was not on file 10 days prior to the default judgment being granted. The order that was signed says the amended return was on file 10 days. That is not true. Wasn't even filed until later. Even if you go with the appellee's arguments that the order granting the motion for amended return was sufficient, it still wasn't on file for 10 days, as was pointed out. At most, it was on file for 3 days. The requirement of 107 is clear that it's 10 days, and the courts have been clear in their strict compliance with the rules regarding default judgment and service. Also, I would say that most of the cases the appellees have recited involved notice and hearing. In the Bavarian case, the party, my position on the Bavarian case is that it's incorrect as to notice, but employer's reinsurance, I brought up earlier, it's under an older version of the rule, which did not include any mention of notice at all. Walker was after notice and hearing. And we address in our briefs that many of the other cases relied upon by the appellees did have notice and hearing. So the defendant was given the chance to respond. As far as the relate back, the general relate back doctrine applies and has been applied to amended pleadings. It has not been applied to amended returns, and there's no reading of Rule 118 that incorporates the relation back doctrine. In summary, I would say that the Rule 118 requires notice. It clearly provides with such notice, and I think it would be bad policy for the trial courts to be able to grant those motions without notice. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Sorry I overlooked your right to rebuttal time. Thank you.
Just one statement regarding this letter case for the supplemental
yes.
briefs. I'm leaving town Saturday. I get back on the 12th. So if they were going to file a brief next week, I would like to have 15 days from the 12th.
Okay, we'll send y'all a written order setting out the days. You have 15 days from today and then 15 days to respond. Think that'll work? Okay. Thank you. Thank you for your presentations. Your case is submitted. You're excused, and the court will stand in recess. I believe there's another argument with a change of panel following this.